In today's episode, we are joined by Alistair Cohen, an Exited founder. In 2017, he founded OnCare, a home care platform which has 100 plus care agencies. During his 6-year journey as founder, he raised approximately 1.2 million for the company, but sold it for a fraction of that. Today, Alistair is going to talk about how he started OnCare, his top three mistakes, and the impact of being a founder on his personal life. Today's episode is part of a short series dedicated to discussing failure, because fear of failure can hold us back, yet it's a prerequisite for success. Failure is a natural part of life that each and every one of us will experience to varying degrees. How we process and learn from it will prepare us for future challenges. Welcome, Ali. It's great to see you again after such a long time.
Hello.
I thought I would introduce the audience to how we know each other, because I've got a lot of guests lined up that I'm meeting for the first time, but we actually know each other. Ali and I worked with each other at a previous company at Moo.com, and Ali was a product manager at the time and I was a test analyst. We were just discussing earlier. It's been about 8 years now. It's so great to see you again and be interviewing you as a founder.
Lots of things have changed since we worked together. I made the silly decision to start a company and sold the company and survived. So yeah, we can talk about all that.
I have so many questions for you, but let's just start with your journey. How did your journey lead up to you starting OnCare?
So the journey prior to actually starting OnCare is a weirdly random one, as a lot of career paths are, and seems to involve my YouTube channel at all points in my career, seems to have been related, which is interesting. So when I was at uni, I was studying mechanical engineering, and I thought that would be more fun than it was. So I thought, if this is not necessarily going to be my career, what do I enjoy doing? And I always wanted to be a TV presenter. So I started this YouTube channel where I just put any random film videos on there. And then I approached TV companies and stuff, and I wanted to know how I become a TV presenter. And all of them told me to get a showreel together. So I was like, all right, well, I started making these videos. I'm just going to keep doing this because it's fun. Stopped worrying about being a TV presenter after a while and just carried on having a YouTube channel because it was good fun. And that was relevant because then some years later, I had done a graduate scheme with Centrica, which is the big energy company that owns British Gas and some others in North America and around the world. I was working in a team called the Emerging Technologies team, which actually, to get that job after the graduate scheme, they were interested in my YouTube channel because they realized that I made kind of gadgety YouTube videos. So that was interesting to them. And then I discovered there's a role at this company called Moo. And the role was for a product manager. I didn't know what product manager was because I'd just come straight from uni to graduate scheme to figuring out what job I'm supposed to be doing. I remember very clearly the job spec at the time was things like, do you like to know about the weird and interesting choices that people make? Do you sometimes do Excel in your spare time? Do you sometimes take things apart just to know how they work, even if you're not always sure how to put them back together again? And it was a very kind of like, yeah, it's like describing me. It turns out that there was a guy, Dave Washer, who was my boss at Moo, and he was looking to hire a load of inexperienced product managers so he could mold them in his product image. All of that was to attract the right sort of person. And again, during the interview process, apparently Dave told me later on that he wasn't that interested in me as a candidate, until he just happened to ask a throwaway question at the end of what do I do in my spare time. And I said, oh, I actually make these YouTube videos called Why Do I Need That, which is gadget reviews, but they're looking at how it makes your life better, which is essentially product basics. And he went, and that apparently was the thing that flipped the discussion. Then we talked about that for a while, and then he brought me to an interview. He actually made me make a YouTube video type thing for my interview process, which he then played in front of the whole company, which was very
bad. I was there when you played that. I remember seeing
you were there at the company at that point.
You played it again. You might have shared it again because I did.
It was, I think when I left, I played it again, but it was, or soon at some point when I was there. But yeah, I think you weren't there when I joined.
No, I wasn't.
But on my first visit to the company, he basically brought me up in front of everyone. Having already watched it in the interview with the interview panel, I was like, we're done now with that video. We don't have to watch it again. And then he played it in front of the entire company at lunch, including, I think, the America team, which is kind of scary. But also was saying, hey, look, we actually appreciate this hobby you have as opposed to British Gas, which is like, don't be it. Human a long term. And so at Moo, I discovered there's this thing called product management, and also then started a product meetup called Product Pints, which is still ongoing, as we were talking about just before the interview. And that was mostly because I didn't know what a product manager was, and I wanted to find out what that meant at different companies. And the best most concise definition that we that came out of all those product type meetups was a product manager is someone who gets the right stuff done and tells people about it. So you have to know what the right stuff is, you have to get it done, and then you have to tell people about it. So there's the elements of that sentence that I quite like. But all of that, building up then a B2B platform within Moo, made a ton of mistakes, figured out that's what product is and what you're supposed to be doing. And it's not just about get some designs from a designer and then buy the dev team biscuits and hope that they can build it all within the time you have. Almost got the whole project shut down. But by the time I left that role, we'd gone from no one in the team except me and some software engineers building a platform to then a general manager, like a 50-strong sales team, UK and US, all selling this B2B platform that we built. Then I did some physical product stuff at Moo as well. Then I left Moo to join this place called Founders Factory, which is where OnCare came out of, which I can get onto kind of the nuances of how that came to be. But essentially, my route to getting to starting my own company was random jobs. Oh, I had loads of other random jobs as well, by the way, just along the way. Like I was a commentator of remote control car races at one point. I was a runner. That's a thing. I was a runner on some TV stuff because I was trying to do that. I had jobs as childminders and worked in a gym for all sorts of other random things when I was younger. But yeah, the Moo job helped me understand what product was, how to do it, how not to do it, and how to then apply that to a different context with some physical products, and how much I loved starting something from nothing. I think that was all of the things that I learned at Moo. And specifically working with businesses, I had a lot of information from the Moo for Business days, which was the first role, which is all the different nuances of how you work with businesses that are different to how you might work with consumers or building out products. But yeah, all of that led me to eventually leave Moo and then discover there was a job at this place called Founders Factory, which is where I started my company. So that's where by chance slash my YouTube channel helped me get most of my jobs.
Yeah.
Up until that point.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your journey within Founders Factory? So maybe people in our audience don't know what Founders Factory is. So maybe you can just explain what Founders Factory is and what you were doing for them.
Yeah. So Founders Factory has two parts to it. It is an accelerator and an incubator. So the accelerator bit is separate to what I was doing. That is where I'm working now. The company Vidsy was actually on the accelerator when I joined. So that's why I'm here now, because I got to know them in their early days. But the accelerator was accelerating existing startups and helping and supporting them to grow and giving them office space and investment and that sort of thing. The bit I joined was the incubator, where the role I was supposed to be doing was, we're going to give you a project to look at. You're going to put your product hat on and you're going to figure out a product that needs to exist in that sector, in whatever market or within that project we're giving you. You get that project to, or that product to early kind of traction, early trials or whatever, or early customers if you can. You've got 6 to 9 months to do that. And then once you've proven something there, we're going to spin it out. Someone's going to take it over and they'll become the CEO of that business and they'll turn it into a proper business rather than a project. And then my job would be move on to the next project and keep going. And what actually happened was, the week before I started at Founders Factory, the guy who was going to be my boss, a guy called Justice, we had a meeting and we were just doing some onboarding stuff. And he met with me and he's got a little notepad and he goes, okay, so I've got two projects I think we're going to give to you. One of them is something we're calling Borrow My Granny internally, which is, we think it's like a care marketplace. The other one's like a podcasting thing, which ended up becoming a business called Entail later on. He was like, I think we'll give you the elderly care thing. So on that on a whim decision that he made in that meeting, essentially changed the course of my life for the next sort of 7-8 years, whatever, and onwards forever, because that was the project I started on. So it had a project name internally, but essentially it's the brief I was given was, go and fix elderly care. You've got 6 to 9 months to find a product that needs to exist in the elderly care sector. And we think a care marketplace is interesting because it's some of the things that are happening in America, but off you go. And that was pretty much it. So then I had to do all of the desk-based research. I knew nothing about the care sector until I started doing this. As much desk-based research as I could do, and then just do my general product thing, just try and understand who the people are, get in bed with them as much as possible, speak to as many people that will speak to me that are family members of people receiving care, the person receiving care themselves, the care workers, the agencies that the care workers work for. So trying to speak to all of these different people and understand all the different things that they're doing. Trying to understand everything I can about all the different players in the space, what the care sector is, how it works, who the regulators are, all of the kind of typical greenfield product stuff where I knew nothing, and spin up a product. And the bit that we decided to focus on was, so because I learned at Move that you can't just build the massive thing to begin with. So we really de-scoped it to work on a specific part of the care sector, which was residential, what we call home care or domiciliary care, as it's known. We were going to focus only in the UK to begin with. And we decided that because it was just me at the time, I realized that there was a bigger opportunity to actually just build out software that would replace people using paper for everything rather than do this care marketplace they thought was interesting. But that was a later version of what the business could become. And yeah, so we then built out a prototype, tested that, had some really awful experiences with piloting a thing that we hadn't catered for working offline. We piloted on the South Coast, and it was awful, and we lost a load of data from the trial, and that went really badly. But essentially what we had by the end of the 9 months it ended up being was, and we being me and the people I'd hustled from Founders Factory to work with me on it, because they had developers and designers and other people internally, was a working, I'd say working prototype or working sort of alpha that we had done a couple of trials with. And when I was doing one of those pilots, there was a client that was actually interested in signing with us, even though we hadn't properly built it yet. And so when it came to the conversation with Founders Factory about spinning out and handing this over, we actually started interviewing for CEOs for who would become CEO of the business. At that point, I thought, I want to spin out with this business because I quite like what I've got so far. I don't really want to pick up another greenfield project because I've put so much into this. And I fell in love with some of the problems that would be solved there. So I thought I'd be spinning out as maybe the CPO or something alongside whoever we were going to hire as CEO. And we did a few interviews. And on interview maybe four, there was a guy who was asking me a bunch of questions. And then two-thirds of the way through the interview, he stopped and went, I don't know that I should be saying this because I'm going to be talking myself out of a job, but I don't think I should be the CEO. I think you should be the CEO because you seem to know all the things that it would take me about a year to catch up with anyway. Plus, you seem to know how to develop the product. So I don't quite know that I'd be the best guy for this when you seem to be suitable. And I didn't know that was an option or think about that being an option. So I just went, huh, that's interesting. And then I spoke to Founders Factory about it. And it said, yeah, I think I've always wanted to start my own business. I'd always had little ideas for things as I've grown up and businesses that could exist and something that was in clothing and something that was, you know, being a TV presenter and always trying to be a bit entrepreneurial with the YouTube and stuff. I'd never had an opportunity laid out in front of me to start a business that would be less risky than doing it entirely on my own, because Founders Factory do put some of that initial capital behind it. I spoke to Henry Lane Fox, who was heading up Founders Factory, and said, I think I want to be CEO of this. Is that possible? My contract said it was, because my employee contract was expecting that to happen at some point, that someone was going to spin out, so my share options were fine, all that sort of stuff. He asked me a load of questions like, have you ever managed a budget before? I said, no. Have you ever hired people before? No, not really. I've been on the panels, but not hired anyone. Have you done this? Because all the answers were no. And I was like, oh, that's not gone well, because I don't really have any experience doing this stuff. And then he went away, talked to his other colleagues and came back and went, yeah, no, we actually think we're going to take a shot at you. We think you're actually the right guy to lead this business. And to be fair, I hadn't done any of those things before my first company either. So yeah, they had a bit of a leap of faith. They was very nice about it as well. They said to me that if it all goes pear-shaped, then I still have a job. I can reapply for a job back at Founders Factory, which is very, that was very encouraging and reassuring. My view on it then was, this is very scary. I don't know that how this is going to go, but it should make me, even if I do this for a couple of years and it all goes terribly, it should make me more employable than having not done it in the first place. So yeah, let's give it a go and see what happens. So that was the decision made. And then I started my own company. The first person I hired was a guy called James, who had worked with me at Moo. So it's like the Moo connection.
Yeah.
The Moo connection never ends. I don't know if you worked with James Broad, but he was my first hire to build the new thing. Would be, we needed a tech person. So James was one of the strongest software engineers I enjoyed working with most in my time at Moo. So he was the first person I called, got him a bit drunk at a dinner, and convinced him it was a great idea to come join me on my little startup, which was just me, for less money than he was earning already. And his wife, and at that time, two children, now three children, should agree to him doing this, because it would be a good opportunity. And then, yeah, he came on board.
That's a fantastic story. I think it's great that you had the support from Founders Factory, the executive and leadership team there, and they gave you that safety net as well. I'm sure that really helped make you feel safe and helped you go forward.
A little bit, yeah. Now I think about it, it's like they had to put £150,000 towards that idea. So it wasn't just them saying, yeah, and off you go, you're going to go raise money now. That was part of their deal. They took a big stake in the company for that, which we had to address later on, but because they changed their model slightly as they went forward. But yeah, they're putting like not insignificant money behind me as an inexperienced founder. But one of the things I think that that gave them faith in me was my process that I had learned when I was at Moo, which is the same thing I use now today. This process called outcome-driven innovation that Dave Washer was very keen on, where you basically just understand what the lives of customers are, what steps they go through to get a job done, and where the biggest sort of opportunities are, pain points that are most important to the client along that journey. So it's not rocket science, but it's a very useful process. And to do that, I actually had to go around at lots of different parts of the country, get up at 6, 7 a.m. to shadow care workers. I shadowed care workers in fairly awful situations, visiting lots of different clients that were not in a great way mentally or physically, or it would be like verbally abusive to the care workers a little bit, and just all sorts of bad stuff I saw. But all of that gives you such amazing context to then build products for these people, because you know how they're feeling, what they're doing. You can see that they've got gloves on. You can see the environments of darkness they're getting up in, and how they're reacting to the clients, even if they're like, all of that stuff you get to see. And then I shadowed people in offices of care agencies and all this other stuff that I think gave Founders Factory more confidence that I knew what I was doing, rather than just, yeah, I'll just take a punt on this guy and hope it works out. But yeah, it was reassuring and very flattering that they decided to give me a shot.
From what I've learned so far is that the first founder is normally the product manager. They need to really understand the problem. So I have in my networking or the networking events that I've been to met quite a few founders. And one of the things that they tell me is that they might say things like, oh yeah, my first idea failed, didn't speak to the customers at all. Or I might meet people at idea stage and they have saved up, they have like their own funding and they've hired a development team to build out their product. And I'm like, how is your testing going? What I'm surprised about, this awareness of lean startup methodology isn't as widespread as you would have thought it would be.
Oh yeah, I've had lots of friends come to me and say, where do you hire software engineers from? I say lots, a few, but like it's happened definitely a number of times. Where do you hire software engineers from? And I'm like, oh, hang on a minute, what are you hiring software engineers for? Oh, I've got this amazing idea for this thing that will help these people. And I was like, oh, that's great. And how many of those people have you spoken to about that? No, not none yet, but I just know it will work. Okay, listen, before I tell you where to hire software engineers from, within the next month, talk to two of those people. Find two of them in a month, speak to them about their problems in their lives. And then you speak to that same friend a month later and be like, so how did they go? Did you talk to those people? Oh, no, I didn't talk to them yet. No, I'm not sure that's going to work out in the end. And you're like, you're asking me where you could spend money on hiring software engineers, but you weren't willing to speak to the people who problem you were going to try and solve. And you then just gave up on the idea anyway because time and commitment and difficulty, whatever. So I'm like, that was definitely a good idea that I didn't tell you where to get software engineers.
Yeah. As we're on the topic, let's dive a little bit more into the lean startup methodology, just to maybe give some basics to people. If they're hearing about this concept for the first time, what is it? And if somebody is toying with an idea, what should they go and do? What should they be doing before they hire the developers?
Yeah. So I suppose there are a couple of things that I would recommend doing before hiring any people or building anything or even designing any product, any solution. And that is to speak to the people that are concerned with that you're trying to solve a problem for, because then it forces you to actually identify who those people are and do they exist. Because some people are like, oh yeah, I need to design a product that's for travelers who are using private jets, but who are wanting to make sure their dog can travel. Like, it's such a small population that you're going after. You have to really make a lot of money on every customer if that's ever going to work. So that's good to identify who your customers are. You do a load of desk-based research once you know who your customers are, who the people you're designing for, even if it's quite broad, to know where they are, what do they do in life, where do they transact, all of this stuff. And you get all of these. I remember in the early days of OnCare, I had a call with someone, like call number two or something. Someone mentions, oh, of course. And then, you know, you've got to keep the CQC happy. And I was like, oh, yeah, of course. And then on my notepad, I write down CQC, underline, underline, question mark. I don't know what that is. And that turned out to be the regulator of the care sector, which I then had to go down a massive wormhole to understand all of the things that they need and what they quiz on and how they appraise care. So you do all that desk-based research, but then, yeah, this outcome-driven innovation process is really handy because it starts to give you an idea of how to understand which problem to go after first, because you might think you know what the biggest problem is. And sometimes it works out that founders who are, who fit the profile of the customer, it can work as well, but it's often they bias their own opinions by the fact that it's like, oh, I have this problem and this is how I experience it. Therefore, this is the thing we're going to go solve for. So I personally think it's often good if you're not the person you're solving the problem for, but you've seen it happen, but you're just not, you're not that person. And yeah, it's the process, just in a nutshell, is trying to map out the job, label the job the person's doing. So in the OnCare example, the care agencies are, are completing the job of managing a care agency, which has all things to do with regulation, hiring, staffing, paying people, all that sort of stuff. The care workers are doing the job of delivering care to clients, which has all the elements of like logistics, getting there, knowing what I need to do, doing it, getting paid for it. And then the clients or the families are receiving care services. That's the kind of job that they're doing. You map out the steps that everyone goes through on that job, regardless of which solution they're using. And then you ideally interview five of those types of people, of each, whichever, whoever you're aiming to solve problems for, to understand at each of the stages of this journey, what is the biggest thing that you're trying to increase, decrease, feel? Or if you haven't got the time to do that, you just say, what's your biggest pain points at any stage of this journey and what most time consuming or challenging thing? So what you then get is you get, you've done a load of research about, you know your market, your people, and all these terminologies you didn't know before. And you also have spoken to people who are not you to validate there is a problem in the first place, because actually the thing you thought was a problem could end up being a thing that people go, yeah, that is a bit annoying, but it's not that much of a problem. The real problem is actually this bit. You were sitting there going, oh, I have a solution. I used to that. That's not a bad thing. But there's an opportunity there if lots of people tell you that's their main problem. And the lean element of doing all that is you have spent £0 up until that point and you have built nothing that needs to be thrown away. You've just gained knowledge. And the other benefit of this outcome-driven innovation process is that when you know all the steps someone's going through, generally the things they're trying to achieve or increase or feel or decrease at each stage, and which of those things is most important to those people, but least well served by whatever method they have today, so it's the biggest opportunity, then you can get into design if you want to, because literally any idea is correct at that point. Beforehand, if you do the ideation too early and you're like, oh, we're going to just come up with any ideas for products that are good for travelers with dogs, whatever the hell thing is, you can be just dotting around. You might miss a key stage in the journey. You might have no idea how to prioritize. But here you've got a very clear thing to solve for a very clear specific type of person. And so therefore it's just about your resource. If you're designing for people who travel with dogs, do I want to build a robot dog handler, which costs billions of pounds to develop and will take 20 years? A lot of people that's probably no. Do I want to build maybe a MVP piece of software that can help manage some of the logistics? Maybe that's actually a better solution, but all of it helps cater for whatever that outcome was that people are trying to achieve. So yeah, the lean element is all about, for me, trying to do as much as you can without spending money, which I have to admit is one of the mistakes I made when I did have money, when I raised money for my startup. But specifically at the beginning, when I was in Founders Factory, this is exactly the process I followed. And I did have to be pretty hustlery about it, because I had to hustle resource to join me. And I had to have enough data to convince Founders Factory they should give me another software engineer or should give me a design to work with or should spin out and make it into a company. So yeah, it was a lot of hustling at the beginning. And then I got some investment and didn't use it very well. But that's the later stage of the thing. I say all this like it's easy. It's not. And that is also part of a good test of whether you should start a company. If you don't have the time or energy to do those things I just talked about, find out about the people, do some interviews, line them up. You have to maybe give up your weekends or your evenings to speak to people or ask your company if you can like speak to people during the daytime or lunchtime, whatever. If you don't have the time or energy or enjoyment to do, that's great to know. Kill it. Don't start that company, because you have to get over that hurdle to even get something off the ground. Otherwise, it's just kind of guesswork. So it's quite a nice test to know, are you still excited by this when you speak to people? Or are you like, oh God, this is boring. I don't want to talk to people about managing dogs on flights. I keep using this stupid example I made up. But yeah, if that's the case, then it could be a great idea. It could be a great business. It could be huge. You're probably not the right person to run that business, because you're not going to be sticking with it in the tough times.
Yeah, personal motivation plays such an important role in what problem idea you're going to solve.
It can do. I was in a very fortunate position with Founders Factory. This is not the norm, I appreciate. And this is a privileged position to be a paid employee who is then given the freedom to work up an idea. Then actually, if it turned out that I got to 6 months or 9 months and I had nothing, or I didn't think there was a business there, if I had nothing, they'd probably fire me. But if I didn't think there was a business there, then I could move on to the next thing and be like, I've done all this, I don't think there's anything here. And maybe they'd be like, okay, fine. A lot of people, yeah, you have to try and do this alongside your main job or use your own money. And that's another risk that you have to be willing to take. I suppose I was risking my career by taking on the company more than anything else. It was a very privileged position, which is why I think places like Founders Factory, or I think Entrepreneur First is another one, are some great places that you can actually, if you get hired into the team, you get a chance to build things with less risk to your own personal life.
Yeah. So let's talk about the journey of being a CEO and founder of OnCare. Can you tell us about moments where you felt you were making mistakes along the way, and how did you overcome them?
Wasting the money I had available and not taking more money when I was offered it are probably the biggest failures of the business. I think there's an underlying element that kind of you touched on at the beginning, which is most people start their first business and they look at it from the product perspective, which is correct. But I definitely didn't look at it from a commercial, strong enough commercial perspective. And that was partly due to the time. I think the world has tightened its belt a little bit now. And at the time when I started OnCare, there was still people hanging on to the idea that you could be Twitter and just build things and raise a load of money, but not worry about the revenue model for a long time. And that would still be backable, which became less and less true. So I was like, I'm going to just build stuff that I know people want, and then I'm going to make up prices and stuff, but I'll fix it later and I'll be fine. And you don't realize how difficult or frustrating it is to then tell customers their pricing's going up significantly just to make the business work and later on. So getting that right is great. But I think, yeah, my first mistake is in hiring, because I didn't have a commercial lead that was there to help us make sure the business was basically earning as much money as it could, or breaking even as soon as possible, or using its money the best once we had raised it. And actually, weirdly enough, when we sold the company for a little while before I departed, it did feel like a kind of good sort of triforce of me on product, James on tech, and then the new owner of the company is the new CEO, who really didn't care about the product or tech, but just cared about the commercials and how and pricing. And he forced us to up the prices of all of our customers, which was a horrible process, but really valuable. And the real valuable thing was learning that one of our customers, we turned their monthly pricing from like £200 a month to £1,200 a month. So like an extra grand a month. This is against a business that was only making at the time 20 something thousand pounds a month. So that was quite a chunk of our revenue. And some of the customers, when we upped their prices, were really angry about it. And they're like, how dare you make this go up by £10 a month? But that one was like, oh yeah, we expected a price rise soon. That's no problem. And there was no problem at all with that, like many multiples of what we were charging them. And we're like, shit, we should have done that years ago. That first mistake is, I think, not being commercial enough. And I went to a product meetup recently where I think that's a trend of the world these days, that actually as a product manager, you can't just get away with what I was actually trained to do, which is the product has to come first. You have to worry about that. And customers have to be satisfied. And the business is a separate thing. You have to have an eye on the commercials as well. And is this making money for the business? And if not, then it's your responsibility as well. So that was the first side of things. And then, yeah, when I raised money, I think the next mistake I made was spending it on things that didn't make a difference to the success of the business. Those included, oh, we have to have a nice office in East London somewhere that cost us like £4,000 a month in rent or whatever, which was silly. And then once we'd signed up our contract some months after that, I met someone who was working out of like the top of a church with his startup, in an unused room at the top of a church, which had toilets and Wi-Fi and everything, and was paying the church like £300 a month or something. Mm. I'm like, yes, we didn't need that. Because the view was, having an office and having a nice office and in East London would help you with hiring, but that didn't really seem to actually make that much difference in the end. Then the people we hired, I definitely made some big old mistakes there. One of my early hires was a sales guy who had previously worked for one of the incumbents, the old kind of competitors that was there. And I thought, oh, hi, he's great because we're going to get information from him about what the market needs, but also what the other product used to do that was good and was bad, and he's going to get sales for us as well. But he was a very strong voice that was absolutely convinced that sector did not respond to digital marketing, and you'd be wasting your time with like Google ads or Facebook ads or anything like that, social media ads. And the way to get these customers was cold calling and taking a TV round in the car and driving to their offices and showing them how it worked. So we believed that, and we did that for a while. And then we hired other salespeople to work under him and to do more of that. And people are really expensive, especially if you're hiring full-time people, which is what we're doing, and probably shouldn't have done that. And when the pandemic hit, or just before, we were running out of money. So we thankfully made the choice to get out of our office contract, which was going to end in March 2020, which was fortuitous timing. But then leading up to that, we're like, oh, this is really sad. We're going to be working from home and everyone's going to be still in offices. And the pandemic hit. I don't know if everyone's working from home now. So that was kind of lucky timing. But we'd had to let go of pretty much all the team except me and James. And then I was like, I don't have a choice but to do digital marketing now, because I can't be cold calling these people all the time. Let's just see if this works. And it soon became a thing that just got us regular leads. People would automatically book demos and then we'd sign up customers. So it became the main way we got customers, and much more repeatable than anything the sales teams did. So yeah, definitely a mistake I made on hiring salespeople when we didn't need them, too many salespeople. And then one of the hire that I made was with for an operations person, with the assumption that we were about to raise a big amount of money, because I was going for an investment round of a million or something. We hired that person. I didn't raise that money. And we forgot that was why we'd hired her, because we were about to get a load more people in the team and had more complex operations. So then she's not got much to do. We're being annoyed that she's not being that effective, but then we didn't give her that much to do. And we had to part ways with her as well as the rest of the team at the time, because yeah, we hired her for things that didn't then pan out. So definitely misused the money that I had, mostly due to things like office and hiring. I think that's probably the biggest mistake. I should have treated like every penny like it was sacred, because I didn't realize how difficult the next rounds of investment were going to be. It's really funny with startups. This is my little insight that I've learned. It's actually much easier to raise money when you've got nothing except a pitch deck and an idea, and when you've got a very successful business. But if you're anywhere in between that, which is counterintuitive, it's very difficult to raise money. So when you had nothing, usually for some reason, like the tax breaks that investors get for SEIS, the investment comes more easily. Plus they're like, they don't have information to back it up. So they're going, do I trust this guy? Does he seem like he's credible? Could he make me money? What about the team? Can he hire? Do I think he can do these things? It's a bit of a gamble. If you then start getting customers, you've got like 20 customers that are paying you, but they're not paying you very much and there aren't that many customers, it's so much harder to raise money, because people are like, okay, I can see some data, but I don't see a lot of progress so far. So I'm going to wait until they get more. I'm like, you were about to put money in when I had nothing.
Yeah, I suppose they want you to reach that point when you're validated your idea, right? But they know it's going to fly, basically.
And the irony of that is, if it's already flying and scaling, I don't need their money to raise more money. So it's a very interesting psychological problem that take as much money as you can early on, even if you have to give up some equity, because it does become very difficult when you have something, but not very much of something. And until you get huge, it becomes, or much bigger, it becomes more difficult, was my experience. And that is one of the other mistakes. I had landed meetings with two big investors. One of them was Alex Chesterman, who started Zoopla, Kazoo, and Love Film originally. We had a very quick meeting. That was the second meeting after I'd met one of his partners he invests with, who also liked the business. And the first guy said, if Alex is in, I'm in. And Alex said, I'm in. How much do you want? But I thought, I'm at the end of a investment round. I already had the money I thought I wanted at that point, which was about 300,000 for that. So at that stage, I don't want to take too much. I don't want to give up too much equity. So I won't ask for very much. I think whatever it was ended up being, Alex had the smallest amount he'd ever invested in anything, even though it was a healthy chunk of money. The problem with that was, when I needed more money later on, they were like, hang on a minute, we said, how much do you need in this first round? Yeah, we'll put more money in, but we want it at the same terms as that first round and the same price, because now the business is worth more and I'm getting screwed out when I actually offered you the money earlier on. So we had to do a load of jiggery pokery to make that happen. I think a lot of people fall short of, oh, I want to save these extra percentage points of equity for myself or for the team or for growth later on. But fundamentally, if the business is successful later on, you can make it work even if you don't have that much, few percentage points fewer. So yeah, big mistake number two was not taking a lot more money when it was on the table, frankly. And then our competitors, some of our competitors were able to raise money off the back of our success, which is also the other absolute kicker of this whole thing, is that you've got investors who are being spoken to by our competitors going, look, these OnCare people are coming after us. We need a lot more money. They raise a lot more money. And I'm like, why not just give it to the OnCare people? Why not just invest in us instead? So yeah. And then because they raised a lot more money, they were able to do a lot more, and we've got more good. Yeah, big mistake on my side.
In hindsight, you can look back and now reflect, oh, these are some of the mistakes that I made and I should have done this instead. How do you emotionally or internally deal with that? Because there are going to be ups and downs and you need to be able to overcome those challenges to move forward. How did you personally move forward?
At the time, I did feel like I was in an abusive relationship with the startup a lot of the time. It's like a situation where you're like, this is making me stressed. It's making me anxious. I'm not sleeping so well. Because some of the worst times is where you go away for Christmas going, I'm not sure how many months of payroll we can cover when we get back after Christmas, but I've got to take a break and try and relax and enjoy myself, which is challenging. Even one of the Christmas days, my birthday's on Christmas Day as well. And one of the Christmas days, I was just trying to close a funding round over Christmas and people had the paperwork and were starting to send me money. And I was like, okay, finally I can take a day off because I can close my laptop because no one's going to be emailing me on Christmas Day and the customers are going to have to deal with that as well. And it's, I can rest for a day or so. But yeah, it was really stressful. How did I get over it? Was being very lucky to have like family support network and different partners at the time, like suffering partners. I mean, it definitely contributed towards ending relationships I had. One of my partners, because I wasn't able to pay myself very much. And one of her motivations was like starting a family and settling down in London. And she was like, you need to have more money than this to raise a family in nice parts of London. I was like, I can't. And I'm not going to let this startup just die for that reason, because it's not my priority to do that yet. And so that kind of ended that relationship. And then I think subsequently the sort of stress that would come out as anger at the world, not in any violent way or at people or anything, but just being a grumpy, annoyed person a lot of the time, I think was one of the contributing factors to my other relationship ending. So that having those people around was great, but that didn't really help that much, or the kind of the startup contributed to failure there. Tried to take holidays, but that's tough, and I wasn't paying myself very much, so couldn't go too many places either. Exercise is helpful because it doesn't cost too much and you can get some stress out running. And I tried to do a bit of therapy over the years as well. And there's an excellent class that is One Rebel, the gym. They have a class called Rumble, where you just get to punch the shit out of a punching bag for most of the class. And that genuinely was quite helpful when you're having quite a stressful week. I don't really know where I found the energy, to be honest. Every year of the startup, up until the year we decided to sell it, I was of the view that like, I've come this far, I can't let it die. I've just got to keep going. And if it can survive and we can grow, we're getting more customers in, it will get to a point where we can break even. I don't have to raise money again. It'll be fine. I can't let it go. It's like my baby and it's my part of my persona. And it's like my life was very much tied to being this startup founder, which has actually been a huge relief that it's not anymore since selling it, because that was quite stressful. But every year that was the feeling until I don't know what really changed, but it just got to enough time and energy where I was like, you know what? I make my peace with the fact that I am a separate entity to the startup. And this year, we're still losing money slowly, but we're still losing money. This is the final year that I think I have the energy to either try and sell it, which is required, which is actually probably the worst, most stressful time of the whole company anyway, trying to actually get through the sale process, because we were trying to balance the very small amount of money we had left, that, and lawyers are very expensive, with getting the deal done. So I was like, I've got to sell the company. Or if we wind it down and just close up shop and sell our customers, I'm really sorry, we can't support this anymore. But yeah, that was something changed that year where I was like, I am no longer the feeling like this thing has to be kept alive. It's probably for my own good and for the good of the kind of, if you use the analogy of it's like a pet, whatever, it's like to put the thing down if it's suffering after this amount of time versus trying to just keep it alive at any cost. Yeah, I don't really have a good answer for how I survived. I'm not a big drinker. I'm not a big drugs guy. I don't even do that much exercise. I just did, that was helpful, but it definitely affected mental health a lot. But I think it was just the reluctance to let it go. And it's really difficult as well, because I see my friends, my peers, I'm seeing them progress through their roles at big companies and talk about bonuses that they're getting and actually be quite annoyed that they got a lower bonus this year than last year. And here's me sitting on like a fraction of the salary that they get as a base and not getting a bonus because I can't afford to pay myself. And I just sit there going, yeah, that must be really bad. Oh, I wonder what that's like. And I had to deal with that. So I lost some of my social standing against some of my peers as I felt it. But I was like, no, it should pay off in the end. It should work out. And it did. It ended. Everything is, I think, all works out when you make it work out. But yeah, I wish I had a good answer for that. Actually, something else that did help, genuinely did help a lot, was going to founder meetups. Founders Factory used to do founder meetups where I work at Vinci now, one of the founders, Archie, would attend those regularly. We would just sit there like venting about startup stuff. That's really helpful because you can then see actually the people you think are doing really well, who on LinkedIn are going, sharing all these amazing posts, actually are struggling with some basic stuff that you actually solved, or you can share ideas, or you can just, yeah, vent at people that know actually what it's like to do that. So if there's any word of advice I could give, I think it would be try and meet other founders and just blow off some steam with them, because you're all probably going through the same crap. And that's quite therapeutic to hear that from other people, especially those that you envision are doing well or better than you. If I had to pin it down, I think that was one of the things I didn't want to miss, is any of those like founder meetups, because they were very helpful to share with other people what's going on. You'd also get tips on how to do things. I suppose it's that kind of shared suffering that you can all go.
I also liked that you shared that you just separated yourself from your business, which helped.
Eventually. But I feel like now I'm coming out of my shell again, even though I don't think anyone else would notice it. But I had this thing I put on myself that when I was the CEO of a startup, that I shouldn't be too silly or inappropriate or a load of other stuff that just natural to my personality. I stopped doing my YouTube videos because I was like, what if one of the investors, well, partly because I have no energy to do them, but also I was like, what if one of the investors sees this and thinks I'm trying to make a sideline on this and not focusing on the business alone? Frankly, I'm sure no one would have cared or even seen them if I'd made more YouTube videos or whatever. But I just put myself in this box of, I'm a CEO of a startup, so I have to act a certain way. And it's just so refreshing and relieving to now be able to be a professional person in a business, but still actually just be myself and know that, especially in the role I have now, that the business having money tomorrow is not my responsibility. And I can just come in and do the best job that I can do. So it's a tough one.
This might be an appropriate time to ask you then, would you do it again?
Yes. But very differently. Raising money, it requires so much time and energy. And it's like job hunting, but repeating it several times. And job hunting is so stressful and demoralizing a lot of the time, because you just apply for things, you don't hear back, or eventually 7 months you hear a no. Actually, maybe with investment it's even worse, because people will take meetings with you rather than like the equivalent of giving an interview. And then you take all your time out of your day to go across London to this swanky office and pitch your heart out to these people. And they go, and the other meeting, look, that's great. Now, obviously, this is far too early for us because we only invest at this point, but I want to take the meeting just to get to relationship with you for late several years. And you're like, what a waste of my time and energy that I've done this. And it's just demoralizing. So I would try definitely to focus on the commercials much more. And then this is the thing I think you hear from a lot of founders, like the first one, it was all about the product, and the second one, it's all about the commercials usually, because then that means you don't have to raise money as quickly if the business is making money better or more sustainably. I think it's the same as my product roles. My first product role at Moo, I had the opportunity to make all the mistakes I could make and almost get it shut down. And as a result, I've never done any of those things in subsequent roles. If I did start a company again, and I do actually have little side gigs that I'm working on, another like clothing thing I've been doing, and a website idea I had. I have another idea for an app that could exist that helps people meet others for games and sports and things. But yeah, if I ever did take that off full time, I would just do it very differently. So maybe, but not anytime soon, because it was only last year that I sold my company. I'm going to enjoy being an employee and earning a reasonable salary for some, let's say years probably, and then maybe the itch will come back about starting another company.
That's great. It's good to know that you'd do it again. I think, so one of the things that came to mind is that I meet people with great ideas that kind of almost too scared to get started, and they think that they need confidence to get started. But what I'm learning more is that also, like, what I'm noticing more is that, like, successful companies, founders of successful companies, a lot of them have been founders before of companies that have failed. And it's almost like all the things that you're learning along the way is going to help you succeed in the future on a future idea. So unless you get started and just have the courage to just do it, even though you might fail, then you're not going to get to where you might be in the future.
Yeah. It depends how you define failure. Failure, we would probably all agree that it's like the company didn't take off and I had to shut it down. That's failure. But it's like relationships, the way I look at it anyway, is that, yes, that relationship is now over, it didn't work out, but what did I learn from it? And how can I apply that to my next relationship? So I either save myself from going into the wrong relationship, or that I don't act in a certain way that makes it go badly.
I suppose, say it even in the lean startup methodology sense, it's like a good thing to keep learning.
Yes. And actually, I've applied that directly to this. I have this t-shirt business that I've got on the side that I'm actually still working on. And it's really interesting because I started it with my ex. And the idea is very simple. It's just that there's this evil eye symbol that's all across Turkey, where she was from, and Greece and the Middle East. It's everywhere. But I hadn't seen anyone do it actually embroidered onto clothes. I've seen like these big, horrible, touristic screen printed t-shirts, but never seen it nicely embroidered with a texture onto clothing that could be then applied to lots of different things. So that was the idea. And I knew it had to be test and learn, because that's how I do things. And we got a designer to design some stuff, which is already some expense because you're paying for a designer's time, to design a logo for the company, what it could be, to design the eye itself, and then get some stuff, some stock printed, some stock made, which is putting £100 and something towards it. But that felt like an acceptable risk to get some trial items that I could list on Etsy, another cost. All of this takes a lot of time because there was iterations with the designer of what it should look like. You have to load it up. You have to take all your time. So I was like, yeah, I'm still quite interested in this. So that's a good sign. And then when the t-shirts came back, the first ones, my ex was like, or she was my girlfriend at the time, was like, these didn't turn out that well. No, let's just can the idea. And I was like, no, they weren't supposed to turn out amazingly. The first thing is to prove, does anyone buy these? It doesn't really almost matter what they look like or how classy they look. She said, no, I don't really want to sell these. I don't really believe in it. And I was like, oh, okay. And then we just dropped the idea because we were doing it together. But when we broke up, I said, look, I'm so interested in the idea. Can I carry it on? And she said, yeah, that's fine. And so I've just been testing and learning ever since then. So I found out that some people bought the t-shirts. I then contacted those people to find out why they bought them and found out things like there's one woman who bought them for going on a honeymoon to Greece. So she bought two. So she and her partner could have these kind of evil eye t-shirts that look nice. Someone else had one in a beauty salon that was in the UK. So I started to get to know where my customers are because the other lady was in America and why they buy these t-shirts. Subsequently, I then just iterated on what the design could look like. I realized it's a terrible idea to hold stock because I was just sitting there on these t-shirts that no one's buying and I had to keep reducing the price. So can I get them printed on demand? Yes, there are some companies that do that. So I set all that up and then I set up a Shopify store and I've just launched recently a kind of Instagram campaign. And all of this is like, how much money am I willing to risk each time to test and learn while I also still have a full-time job? Because I don't want to make this my full-time thing until it starts showing success. So yeah, you have to do all these like test and learn things, even though none of them are particularly glamorous. And as I was saying at the beginning, you have to get used to the fact that no one cares about it for some significant time. Like my YouTube channel, I've actually had experience with that. So that's quite good to know how much of a slow burn these things are. But I'm learning so much about how clothing is made, how it can go wrong, that the fact that how you integrate a Shopify with an actual producer, how that all ties together, how you get the things designed, how you do the marketing, what happens if it goes wrong, like all of this stuff I'm figuring out is actually just really interesting to me because I just didn't know how any of it worked before. It shouldn't be scary to get started, but you're just trying to, every opportunity, even if it's not going to work out, because it still might not work out, I still might be like, I spent several hundred pounds on the Shopify thing and on the marketing, and I'm still not getting any sales. This is at a point where I'm just now spending money for no reason. I probably should shut it down. So that might still happen. But I still learned tons of things and found it quite interesting and have some cool items of clothing at home that I can wear myself. Yeah. I now forget what your original question was.
When you're going to use it again at that. is going to, I think Steve Jobs had this thing about the sort of joining the dots, just do things that interest you. And then like eventually the dots will join up.
Yeah. Like, oh, and that's, yeah, my YouTube channel helped me to get the job at Founders Factory because they saw that. My YouTube channel helped me to actually become a Vidzy creator, which then subsequently helped me to get the job at Vidzy, which is all about video ads and video making and content creation, which I've done bits. So yeah, and that was just my interest. That was just my hobby. Mm-hmm. And then this t-shirt thing now, when I was applying for jobs recently, gives you an in as if you're looking for an e-commerce company to join. I now have some, I've done a whole e-com project of my own that could ultimately be a massive failure. But the fact that I've done bits of it, people are like, that would be a useful experience. So yeah, you're right. I think you're right. It's having to follow something that it doesn't even need to be a problem that exists in your own life, but you have to just be interested enough in it to keep going at it.
I think what comes to mind is I have a friend who makes amazing beauty products. I've bought them off her. And I thought, when are you turning this into a business? She really wants to have the business. And I'm just waiting. I've got to get more confidence first. I'm going to become a teacher to get more confidence. I'm like, no,
don't use
some of your products, please.
People will find all sorts of excuses. It's really funny, actually, because also my brother-in-law started a company or an idea, which was basically making money through Amazon referrals, which a lot of people do. Lots of websites exist, like top ski boots you could buy 20 foot, and they're all just Amazon links that they make money if you click through and buy stuff. But his angle on it was taking one or two very clear products, like TVs that people don't really know what TV they need, and mobile phones people don't know what mobile phone they should get sometimes, having a quiz that they could fill out that then would basically steer them to one of X options that existed on Amazon that would link through, or on TV or phone. And he was doing it for a few months and was like making a few £1,000 a month already. I think he was making more than we were making at OnCare when we had an actual team of people that had raised money and had, you know, employees and whatever. He was just doing that as a side gig, but he was making way more money than we were. He just lost interest in it. He was like, yeah, I don't really see that. I want to carry this on. So even when it's successful in other terms, it's still just not the right business for you because of either the time in your life or your interest or something else happens and you just, I want to spend time with my partner or whatever. It's just, there's so many, it's such a steep pyramid of startups where the bottom is all the ones that was the first bottom layer is ideas that people have, which is infinitely massive because everyone has ideas. Then it very steeply drops off to a much thinner layer of number of people that actually do anything about those ideas. And then just gets progressively exponentially smaller of people who then stick with those ideas. Mm-hmm. And then the very small percentage of those ever make it to anything that makes money. And even smaller percentage of those make it to those that could make lots of money. But yeah, there's a huge drop off of that, like nothing to something and something to going to bother carrying on with it because it's just so easy to go, I'm just not interested anymore. This is not immediately taken off. So I'm just, I don't know. Yeah,
that's also fine though, isn't it? If you realize, because like you mentioned, having a startup, like hearing your stories, it takes so much out of you and it's, you have to go through all these hurdles. I think to recognize I'm not interested in this enough to turn it into a business
It's gold. It's absolute gold. Some people don't recognize that soon enough. And actually, one of the things I look back on was a decision that I took in like year two of OnCare or something, where I was like, if we don't raise this much money, then it's a signal from the market that it's not really happening and we should shut it down. I think we raised just under whatever that amount of money was that I was going to accept. But I still was like, oh, okay, that's enough. Who can tell you what would have happened? I might have been miserable. I might have taken all sorts of things. It might have gone much worse. And I wouldn't have sold a company and built it up, whatever. But yeah, maybe it was in the early days sort of signs that it wasn't going to take off, or I wasn't the right person to make it take off as a non sort of commercial person. Maybe we should have shut it out. But yeah, no, it's absolutely valuable. It's gold dust to know very early on that you should not be leading a business that you're not interested in, and rather than like stick in the same way as any relationship. Some people should ignore all the signs there that they're in the wrong relationship, and then they patch over that with either excessive something or getting married or having children or whatever when they know they're miserable, as opposed to just admitting that it's not right for them and doing something else. But yeah, same applies for startups.
Yeah, I suppose you have to recognize the sacrifices, and are you willing to take those sacrifices or make those sacrifices?
And being honest with yourself, is this actually making me miserable more than it has any sort of upside? And I think for me, it wasn't, until that final year where I was like, yeah, this is now making me more miserable than it's making me see benefit of where this could go. So let's just do something different and sell it or shut it down.
Yeah, but still an amazing journey, and you've taken out the, you've gained so much from doing it.
Yeah, I don't want to lose that. I would still like to make sure I apply what I learned to any role that I take on and talk to other people about it and whatever else. I just don't want to be a CEO for a little while. For sure.
It's been incredible hearing your story. This series is dedicated to talking about failures and overcoming failures, and that's why we've touched on so many points to do with failure. Final question now. Any heroes that you have, and why are they a hero?
I'm going to say I am the hero of this story because I am proud of myself that I made it through somewhat intact mentally and physically what was essentially one of the hardest periods of my life, and the feelings of just being responsible for others' livelihoods and knowing that I'm going to have to find a way to make it work and putting up with all of that kind of peer disappointment against other friends who were progressing in life much more than me, but sticking with it. Yeah, I'm very lucky. A lot of things are very lucky. I have a good support network, family, I get on well with, all sorts of things that make me very fortunate. But I'm gonna big up myself in this instance because I think I did well. I am an exited founder, which even though you can sell a company, turns out for not very much money, because a lot of people, when they hear that I sold a company, they're like, why are you at work then? What are you doing? Just assuming that it's always going to be millions. It's not. You can sell a company for a pound. We sold it for more than that, but not a huge amount more. Enough that I could take a few months off work. That was great. That was like not life-changing, except for the fact I got some great trips that I did and was able to take all 4 months in the end to myself just to do whatever I want to do. And that was amazing. And it's resulted in me getting a job at a company that I really like working at, that I had great connections to already, that wouldn't have come about if I was still the startup. I'm an exited founder and have some good knowledge and stories to tell and can ideally support other people in the future and try and use what experience I had in ongoing roles. I didn't stick with it so long that it destroyed my life. So I'm proud of myself for making some of those brave decisions as well.
That's definitely a good thing. Great. Thank you so much for sharing this journey with us. I'm sure it'll be incredibly helpful for people who are thinking about starting their own business or already on the journey. You shared so much.
Yeah, I don't. Hopefully, I haven't like discouraged anyone. Like, oh, screw that! I'm not going to go through any of the stuff that guy's got through, because my experience is not the same as anyone else's experience. But yeah, hopefully, there's some watch points to avoid through what I did.